From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very grateful for you. We never take you for granted. We always are appreciative of the support you give us. Today, as the world around us changes in unsettling and unexpected ways, it really is more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often go unheard. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Tuesday is the Hindu New Year, and April 1st marks the Orthodox Christian Lazarus Sunday. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, the latest ugly strategy to institutionalize anti-gay bias in the name of religious freedom has been demonstrated in Kentucky, where Governor Matt Bevin signed a law that lets students at public universities and high schools turn away LGBT students. The law claims this will permit, quote, students to voluntarily express religious or political viewpoints. The Institute for Social Policy and Understanding has issued a report titled American Muslim Poll 2017, Muslims at the Crossroads. In that document, 60% of American Muslims reported personally experiencing religious discrimination in the past year, compared with 17% of the general population. 42% said their kids had experienced bullying in the previous year. And President Donald Trump will deliver the commencement address at the evangelical powerhouse Liberty University, according to a report in the Washington Post. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
I would like to thank the evangelical and religious community because I'll tell you what, the support that they've given me has been so amazing.
This past week, investigative journalist Sarah Posner laid out the intense synergy between the political religious right and other Donald Trump supporters in as comprehensive and comprehensible a way as I've yet seen. She did it in the pages of The New Republic, and the headline sets the tone. Amazing Disgrace. We'll talk with Sarah about this article and the first-person interviews that it's built upon when Sarah joins me on this week's show.
Over the last two decades, we've covered several major shifts across America's religious landscape. Interfaith dialogue usually consisted of Christians and Jews getting together.
One of the biggest changes since then has been a rising recognition of America's complex religious diversity.
Many of us were deeply saddened to learn that the long-running public television program Religion and Ethics News Weekly was ending its run after almost two decades. The show's managing editor and correspondent, Kim Lawton, has agreed to join us for a look back at her tenure with the show, as well as the special challenges facing religion journalism today, and she'll be here later in the hour. But first,
no one remembers who John Hancock was, but they know that that's a signature because he wrote his name so bigly, big and boldly.
You just said bigly.
Bigly.
And I just won $5.
Many of the week's political headlines have dealt with confirmation hearings for the president's nominee to the Supreme Court, Judge Neil Gorsuch. One of the nation's most able analysts regarding the High Court is journalist Dahlia Lithwick, and we are extremely fortunate that we could catch up with her Dahlia Lithwick, thank you for stepping out of the hearing for a moment to talk with State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
We're speaking on Thursday morning. Dahlia, you've written compellingly in Slate magazine about Neil Gorsuch. You have said in relation to him that he is hatched in a federal society lab. Talk about what you see here and what you're hearing here and how you characterize this.
Well, you know, I think that sort of overshadowing this entire hearing, there are two problems that make it very, very hard to proceed as though this is, you know, the same as the Sam Alito or Elena Kagan hearings. Mm-hmm. One problem is that this is a seat that has been vacant for more than a year, that when Justice Scalia died in February, Barack Obama tapped Merrick Garland for this seat, and that remained vacant due to the decision to obstruct, not even to have a hearing or a vote. Many of the Republicans in the Senate refused to even have a courtesy meeting with Merrick Garland. So that is very much overshadowing this hearing, and one senator and another on the Democrat side are saying, I don't even understand why we're here. This seat was not Donald Trump's to give. The other problem is that the president is currently under investigation. We know the FBI has confirmed there are issues with whether he should be seating someone who will have lifetime tenure at the court. Neither of these things are Neil Gorsuch's fault, but he's certainly been asked about both of them. But I think that there is this slight cloud over, you know, just doing business as usual. That said, he's been a tremendous nominee. He's been a really strong and able witness. I think everyone's been impressed with, you know, how affable and warm he is. So he's done a really, really good job of effectively selling himself, although he has certainly not spoken in any level of detail about his views on any subject. But I think there's a little bit of a clash here between whether this hearing should be happening at all, given the current situation and given what's happened in the past, and between the fact that he's clearly qualified by any standards.
You know, the word extreme has been so overused in recent years that it's kind of losing its meaning. I don't listen as carefully as you do and know how you listen. I see him as being all that you said, but extremely evasive to the point he said a whole lot, but I don't know what he said. Do you see Gorsuch as an extreme choice?
It's a great question, and I think it's the one that every single person who's been sitting in this hearing room for 3 days is asking themselves, quite honestly, because he has said actually even less than Justices Alito, Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor, Justice John Roberts, folks who have come before have at least been willing to speak somewhat about case law and precedent and cases that have been decided even decades ago. He is just taking the stance that he will say virtually nothing. And he also won't talk about politics, he says, and he won't talk about, any of his sort of general views. And so you're left really trying to figure out, based on his past record and his academic writings and his political writings, whether he is extreme. So sort of the benchmark is, we don't know, because he's told us very little of substance. That said, I think that record is a 10-year record on the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals. We know what he's written in the past. I don't think anyone doubts, based on that record, that he is very much a conservative, very much in the mold of Antonin Scalia, very much a self-identified originalist in his interpretive method. We have 10 years of cases where he has certainly, I think it's fair to say, generally had a thumb on the scale, in favor of big corporations, against plaintiffs in employment discrimination cases, against, say, students in cases where they are seeking relief under various statutes to give them protection. So I think that we can look at his record in aggregate and say this is a person who's very much like Justice Scalia. And then the question becomes, I think your underlying question, whether that in itself is extreme. And the answer to that is we don't even know anymore what extreme looks like. I think there are a lot of people who would say Justice Scalia was an extreme version of a textualist and originalist, was not sort of a centrist justice. But certainly Judge Gorsuch's defenders are saying, first of all, he's a very fine person and a good judge. And second of all, that there's nothing extreme whatsoever about the position he's taken with respect to, for instance, corporate, corporate speech or protecting corporations from having to violate their religious views. He's very, very strongly on that track. And then the question becomes whether that is too extreme for, America.
Could you calm some of my anxieties about him? I don't see him being a stickler for religious liberty, as the Constitution says, so much as a spokesperson for the new revisions of what religious liberty means.
Well, I think it's probably the fundamental question that a lot of us have been wrestling with in his record. I think he has been a very strong protector of religious liberty for some people. I think that he has very much, I would say, erred on the side of making sure that people are protected under the Free Exercise Clause of the Constitution, under RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that was passed to bolster the individual conscience rights and free exercise rights of people of faith. And so in that sense, I think he's been a real promoter of religious liberty. I think that the other provision of the First Amendment that really worries about the establishment of religion, of any one religion, is one that he's willing to downgrade. And so if you think, as I do, that some of the central cases to watch the Supreme Court in the last few years are things like the Hobby Lobby case or the Little Sisters of the Poor case, where people of one faith are saying, my religious liberty is so compelling that the religious interests of third parties who my behavior affects almost disappear. Gorsuch has been very much not just in agreement with the Supreme Court on those cases, but out ahead of them, would go further to defend those religious liberties. And so I think that's important. The Constitution has tremendous solicitude for conscience rights of religious people. But I think that it has been very, very much at the expense of people who are not of that faith and very, very much privileged, and this is what's important, over just basic civil laws, neutral laws of how we conduct ourselves. And so really, I think the thing that if you're thinking about religious liberty, the question is always going to be when you do these balancings of how far does my religious liberty extend and at what point is it allowed to undermine just basic statutory rights of others. I think Gorsuch is way out in front of that conversation, and it will really be interesting in a sense, because this is an issue on which Justice Scalia was a real pioneer, to see if Judge Gorsuch is even further than Justice Scalia would be. And we can't know that. All we can do is look at his record. But I think his record does reflect, if you think about the fact that the cases that are going to come to the court in the next few years are going to be pharmacists who don't want to give birth control or cake bakers who don't want to bake a cake for a same-sex couple, I think Gorsuch will be very, very strongly on their side and not on the side of the people who may be harmed by those religious beliefs.
A lot has been written about the recent politicization of the Supreme Court. You have such deep experience in observing the court. It'd be really valuable if you'd give us your perspective on whether we're seeing actual fundamental change or whether this is all just within the ebb and flow of our democratic system.
We're clearly, I think, at a moment of unprecedented politicization of the court. And I think you need to look no farther than Donald Trump for the first time running a campaign on the promise that he would fill the seat with someone who would reverse Roe v. Wade. He would fill the seat with somebody who would bolster gun rights after the Heller case. I mean, those kinds of promises have not been made. And so in a sense, turning the court itself and the vacancy into a political football, we've never seen it extended this far. In that sense, it is extremely polarizing and extremely political. I think the deeper question is, you know, we have a court that really does pride itself on being above politics, above ideology, above the fray. One of the things that Judge Gorsuch had said over and over again in his testimony is, look at Supreme Court decisions. You tend to think, oh, 5-4, 5-4, always the same patterns. But it's really important to realize the majority of the cases are decided 9-0, 8-1. You know, this is not, at the end of the day, a political body. I think the response to that in the hearings, if that were the case, Judge Gorsuch, if all judges are just judges and not liberal or conservative, why is Merrick Garland not sitting in the chair that you're sitting in? And so I think that, you know, there is always this tension, and it's in some sense an existential question, that the court is meant to be above politics. It's meant to rise above the fray. The black robes are meant to be symbols of we are something other than that. But I think the process itself has been so broken, and the norms around that have been so shattered in the past year that it's awfully hard to think that that's anything less than magical thinking. Mm-hmm. And really, I think what you're seeing playing out in these hearings, and I confess that I have become cynical because of this, is the kind of double-edged sword of saying, oh, the court is above this, Judge Gorsuch is above this, it's none of this is political, please don't corrupt the integrity of the judicial branch by talking in political terms, at the same time as having said, and Ted Cruz continuing to say throughout these hearings, look, you know, Democrats are liberal and they get it wrong, and originalism is the only theory, and this is Judge Scalia's seat and it must be filled by a conservative. So I think you can only walk the line between those two postures for so long before it starts to look like it's all a sham. And it seems very much as though once that's broken and once the American people start to say, hey, this is just politics, it's no different from any other branch of government, you've lost something very essential, really is the only power the court has in this country, which is the power of its integrity and public belief in its integrity. And I do worry a little bit that we've slipped into that chasm and that I don't know how we recover.
Daya, I know we've got to go. I just am curious, has anything surprised you in this confirmation process, or do you just go home at night and say, well, here's another?
I think probably the surprise, to the extent there's been one, is that Judge Gorsuch has been less forthcoming than his predecessors. I think that when you have someone, you know, let's recall Elena Kagan came to the bench with no judicial experience. Judge John Roberts had only a few years judicial experience, and yet they were willing to talk pretty openly, both about their records and about their views of precedent. And I say openly with the caveat that none of the justices in the last years, probably since the Robert Bork hearings, have really opened up about their judicial views, but nevertheless a willingness to say something, anything about whether a case was rightly or wrongly decided. Judge Gorsuch has really drawn the line. He is simply not willing to open up about anything of that sort. And so really, I think even in a world where the bar is set so low in terms of people sharing their interpretive and judicial values and their views of prior cases, we got even less than usual. And that's extremely frustrating when, if the point of this enterprise is to figure out what is this person going to be like, we're giving him lifetime tenure, and he's only 49, so that's a lot of years. I've been actually, I think, surprised by his reticence and the extent to which we're just going to have to kind of take him at his word that he is a fine and good judge and, you know, he'll do his best.
Daya Lithwick writes about the courts and law for Slate Magazine. She's a much sought-after commentator who also hosts Amicus podcast. We spoke on Thursday morning. Honestly, Daya, there's nobody else I'd rather talk with about the Supreme Court than you. You have such great insight, and I appreciate you taking time to step out of the hearing and be with us on State of Belief Radio.
It was absolutely my pleasure. I thank you for having me.
Kim Lawton is an award-winning journalist who has done a lot of vitally important reporting during her many years as managing editor and correspondent at Religion and Ethics News Weekly, the public television program that has just concluded its almost 20-year run. She also is a good friend. I'm delighted to be able to talk with Kim Lawton here on State of Belief Radio. Kim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to talk with you.
How has religion journalism changed, do you think, in the past two decades?
Well, I think it's gotten more complicated, even as the religious landscape here in America has gotten more complicated. When the show first went on the air, I used to say interfaith dialogue was a bunch of Christians and Jews getting together. And now I think we're just so much more mindful of the diversity that's here, the diversity among Christians, Muslims, Jews, Sikhs, Hindus, so many different faith groups, and each of them playing a role that as religion journalists we felt was important to cover. So that just made the topics and the issues so much broader and more complicated.
I remember the earliest years when I was at the Interfaith Alliance, we could hardly get a news outlet talking about religion. They said they wanted to do politics, not religion. It seems now that everybody wants to talk about religion and politics to the point that you can't talk about one without talking about the other. What do you think was most influential in causing those changes?
Well, I think, again, the growing recognition of the diversity in this country, but I am concerned that so much of religion coverage is still so political, and it's done through a lens of politics, especially in recent years. I know I did a lot of reporting about the Muslim community, and certainly there are many important political issues tied to Muslims and how this country views Muslims and treats Muslims, but when I that seemed to be the focus. The focus was terrorism or fighting terrorism or politics. And when I tried to do a story about basic beliefs or community issues or stories, the community itself, the Muslims that I talked with, were so grateful because they said, all anybody wants to talk about is politics and terrorism. And I think that's a danger. The same thing even now with so many religious communities. Everything goes back to politics. And certainly, well, that's important. That's not all that religion is about.
Mm-hmm. Is there one story or are there two stories that you got to cover that stands out for you looking back on your time in this program?
Yeah, I know. People ask me that, and that is really hard. I did over 1,000 stories for our show in the 20-year run, so that's a lot to choose from for sure. There was a certain grouping of stories that always meant a lot to me, and that was during times of crises, looking at how faith-based groups mobilized to help their neighbors, and that was across the board, across faith communities, just in general. But I was very fortunate to go to places like Sri Lanka after the tsunami. I spent a lot of time in Louisiana and New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. I spent time in Haiti after the earthquake. And most recently, I spent time at refugee camps. I went to the border of Syria and Turkey. And, so many times the stories about those issues also get politicized, but yet to see the suffering, number one, but then to see people, regular, everyday, ordinary people, giving up their time and in some cases risking their lives to help other people. Those stories really stood out for me because often I felt like they didn't get the attention that I wish they had.
You've worked in different media formats. What kind of religion story does television lend itself particularly well to covering?
Well, I think the visual is such a powerful vehicle to tell a story. And, there are some stories that just really shine when they're told through video. For example, I was just talking about the refugees or after the earthquake in Haiti. A print reporter can say, oh, it was devastating and so-and-so's house collapsed. But when you see the rubble, when you see people's lives strewn about the sand and the ground, and when you see the pain on people's faces, when you see the poverty, and you visually can connect with it. I think those stories are very powerful. When you watch people worship and you see this thing that happens that's almost can be transcendent, and you watch it, you don't have to, you know, I can't explain that with words, mm-hmm. but I think seeing it in a visual can be very strong. Now, on the downside, it can be really challenging when you're doing a story about, certainly the sex abuse crisis mm-hmm. is a little challenging to cover in video, or even complex theological ideas when people talked about having shared communion between Catholics and Protestants or something. I mean, yes, you can see communion, but when you talk about some of the theological ideas behind what was going on, that gets a little more complicated.
Let's talk a little bit about today. When you look at how coverage of religion seems to overlap so frequently with politics, do you see a way for us to extricate ourselves from that poisonous combination, or is the reality now just as politicized as so much of the news coverage seems to be?
I think that the reality is pretty politicized these days. And that's not to say that's all there. Again, that's not all what religion is. And many people, you know, they go to their house of worship, they're involved in their community, and they don't really think about politics. And I think I'm based in Washington, so I think it's easy to get sucked into that, but we are in a very politicized time and a very divided time. I mean, in the faith groups, at least the ones that have a voice in Washington and that are active in Washington, there is a lot of division among those groups as well. For even something like the confirmation of a Supreme Court justice, I'm getting emails, really strong emails from faith groups, very much in support of what they think he might bring to the court, and very much concerned and against that him, mm-hmm. and raising concerns about what he might bring to the court. So I think, you know, some of these political issues really do have real-life consequences, and that's something the faith groups are concerned about, and I think they should be concerned about. But again, as a journalist, I need to remember that's not all they're up to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What is your take on this fake news phenomenon that is getting highlighted?
As a journalist who might be sometimes considered old school, I think the truth is what we should always pursue. And I'm a little concerned about so much of news coverage, and I put that in the scare quotes, you know, the air quotes, so much of news is really talking heads' opinions. It's not news. It's not journalists. It's pundits and talking heads, and that's not journalism. And I think the American public can get that mixed up sometimes. But fake news, it, you know, is used just to cover things that people don't like to hear, and that really troubles me. I hope consumers of news, I hope our audiences take time to say, is this true or is this false? But they need to examine the sources that they're getting their information from. You know, I always want to say to people when they say, oh, that's fake news, I want to question them, what do you mean by that? Is it untrue? Is it unpopular? Is it something you don't want to hear? What does fake news mean? Mm-hmm. But certainly there's a challenge for the journalism community as well, that we do pursue the truth, and we do make sure that what we report is truth and not just politics or opinions or all of that. It's just a very strange time.
Mm-hmm. Do you see the current administration being particularly good at manipulating religion for political ends?
Well, they certainly, you know, are doing it, but they're not the first ones that ever did that.
Right.
You know, when I've seen a lot of religious groups in and out of the White House and having relationships within administration, trying to have an influence. You know, many people have said that they see a more, I'm not sure what the word would be, but maybe manipulative bent this time around. But certainly I think the religious community needs to be very concerned about how they're being used, if they're being used, if they're being exploited. That's always a challenge. And I've heard some, even among evangelicals who are very close with this administration, but I've heard in the evangelical community people raising concerns about that relationship, as they have in the past. There have been people raising concerns about the relationship between Republicans and evangelicals and saying, you know, what did evangelicals ever really get out of those relationships in the past, for example, under the Bush administrations, plural, But even now I'm hearing even louder voices and more division among evangelicals raising concerns about that, about being exploited.
How much responsibility do religion journalists bear for exposing the misapplication of religion in politics and government?
Well, I think that there is, you know, a responsibility not to just regurgitate press releases, but to ask tougher questions in the religion community and ask people what they're doing, why they're doing it, and look at, you know, how that may line up with what others in their community say or how others interpretate their scriptures, for sure. It's a responsibility, but it shouldn't be a crusade. I think if I'm a journalist, I look for facts and I investigate what people say, but I have to be careful not to make it my own crusade as well.
One of the great compliments, and rightly, about your show was, in some ways, people went there, turned on that show and said, well, here we know we're going to get the truth. So what would you say to savvy consumers of religion news? What should they be paying closest attention to in the weeks and months ahead?
Well, and just, you know, first of all, I want to thank you for that, because I felt like that was something we tried really hard to do, was to be balanced as much as we humanly can. And obviously we're all human beings, but when the news came that this show was ending, I heard from people on the left and the right, you know, just expressing thanks and saying, I always felt that you treated me fairly. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, what I always tried to do as a journalist, is to let people speak for themselves, too, and to be honest about that and not try to pull out the quote that most agrees with what, you know, works best for my story or something, and to really listen to what was being said. And I guess I would say for consumers of religion news, just make sure that you have some diverse sources that you're paying attention to, and don't always look for outlets that make you feel comfortable or that reinforce what you believe. Make sure you're, you know, looking around. Is this what all Catholics are saying? Is this how all Muslims think? And just trying to be, I mean, I know that's a lot of work for people who have busy lives, but just even on your Twitter feed or your Facebook feed, make sure you have some diversity of voices, even if it makes you mad sometimes or uncomfortable, but just make sure you're hearing from a lot of people.
If you're able to talk about it, Kim, what's the next chapter for Kim Lawton, professionally speaking? What would you like to do next?
Well, we just sort of wrapped things up at the beginning of this month, so it's only been a couple of weeks. I've taken some personal time just to sort of decompress a little bit. And, you know, I honestly don't know what my next steps may be. I'd like to stay in the world of religion reporting. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's something that I've done a long time and is close to my heart. I'm exploring a couple of possibilities, but just not sure yet where the future may be. I think there is room for voices out there, journalistic voices, that want to cover religion in the way that I do, which is trying to be even-handed and objective, even right. In this world of sound bites and talking heads. So we'll see. I'll keep you posted.
Do please. Kim Lawton is an award-winning journalist who for many years served as managing editor and correspondent at Religion and Ethics News Weekly, the public television program that has just ended its almost 20-year run. Kim's body of work is immensely valuable, and I look forward to the next chapter of that work. For now, Kim, thank you for what you've done. You have been an excellent reporter, and you are a really representative of the truth. Thank you for what you've done, and know that we're interested in where you're going from here. We want to keep up with you. And thanks for today being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
It's a particularly provocative headline. Amazing disgrace. How did Donald Trump hijack the religious right? You'll find it over a comprehensive article published in the New Republic. And I'm very happy to welcome the author, investigative journalist Sarah Posner, who has been covering the 2016 election and its aftermath in partnership with the Nation Institute Investigative Fund, back to State of Belief Radio. Sarah, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me again, Welton.
Use the experience of Russell Moore, the head of the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, as kind of a model for how unstoppable the rush to Trump has been.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start there. Discuss what happened to Moore.
Pretty much from the outset of Trump's presidential campaign in 2015, Moore was an outspoken critic of Trump and an outspoken predictor that evangelicals would not coalesce around Trump's candidacy. I mean, after all, there were 16 other candidates that evangelicals could have gone with. And so Moore spent much of the primary campaign cycle laying out the reasons why evangelicals shouldn't vote for Trump, why evangelicals wouldn't vote for Trump, ranging from Trump's personal behavior to his racist and xenophobic rhetoric. But then, as it turned out, Trump not only got the nomination, but won the general election with 81% of the white evangelical vote.
It really does seem like anybody who gets in the way of Trump and his supporters just gets steamrolled, no matter how prominent they may be. Moore has issued two apologies so far. Where do you see all of that being right now?
Well, within the Southern Baptist Convention, there's a divide between the Moore supporters and the Trump supporters. Many of the Trump supporters, and here I'm talking about pastors as opposed to people in the pews, are megachurch pastors like Jack Graham or Robert Jeffress from Dallas, Texas. And many of the Moore supporters tend to be pastors of smaller churches or pastors who might be involved in pro-immigrant activity or refugee resettlement kind of activity. They're less involved in national, like, electoral politics, less likely to, you know, talk about, oh, America's a Christian nation under threat by secularists, you know. But I think that the supporters of Moore perhaps overestimated Moore's influence among people in the pews, particularly when it came to immigration reform, the Southern Baptist Convention's views on race, or efforts to, get past some of its past history on race, and obviously on whether evangelicals would vote for Donald Trump.
Yeah. Trump got more white evangelical votes than George W. Bush. How do you interpret that? What does it mean?
I think there were a few things going on. One was that Trump brought out a kind of evangelical voter that is not of the stereotype. I think the stereotype is the voter who protests outside abortion clinics and goes to church every Sunday and every Wednesday Bible study and is on the mailing list of the Family Research Council and Focus on the Family, et cetera. I think that's the stereotype of the white evangelical voter. I think Trump brought out another kind of white evangelical voter who maybe doesn't go to church as often or maybe does, but hasn't necessarily been engaged as a soldier in the religious rights culture wars, although they nonetheless feel what they believe to be the sting of an abandonment of their quote-unquote way of life or the way things used to be. And that probably has more to do with race than religion, and I think that that is why those voters came out for Donald Trump.
Sarah, you remind readers that the political evangelical religious right has crafted a creation story for itself that is false. How has racism always been a core component that is a major factor, isn't it?
Well, back in the 1970s, when the religious right as a political movement hitched to the Republican Party was trying to find its sea legs, mm-hmm. the IRS, under President Jimmy Carter, revoked the tax-exempt status of Bob Jones University, right, which is a fundamentalist university in South Carolina, which at the time had a policy banning interracial dating. This was seen by many on the religious right, particularly those who had longstanding issues, shall we say, with school desegregation. This was seen by them as an assault on religious freedom. Now, the reason why this is so important, not just in terms of the race origin story of the religious right, but in terms of like the where the religious right is vis-a-vis their relationship with government right now, because what you have is them saying this is a government intrusion on a religious organization's interpretation of the Bible, and the government should not be doing that for religious organizations or religious schools like Bob Jones University. So they framed it as government intrusion on their religious freedom. Well, think about the way they are framing almost every issue that they're taking on today, so many decades later. Having to provide a wedding cake to a same-sex couple is framed as intrusion on religious freedom. Having to provide contraception coverage to your employees is framed as a religious freedom intrusion. But the reality is that with Bob Jones, that this had to do with racism, yet they took this on as a cause that still reverberates today in the religious right. But this is what really got them going. Now, later, of course, they framed their origin story as being about abortion. Of course, it's true that abortion is a very important issue to the religious right now, but it was not an immediate trigger for them when the Supreme Court issued the decision in Roe versus Wade in 1973.
You use the term alt-right Christians. This is a really important concept, I think, for us to understand what's going on. Talk about that, please.
So part of what I talk about in the article is that the religious right now finds itself in coalition with the alt-right by virtue of the fact that they're both a major part of the coalition that supports Donald Trump and supported Donald Trump in his election. The alt-right, I think, it's seen largely as this sort of motley movement that's racist and misogynist and xenophobic and Islamophobic. You know, Steve Bannon famously told me that Breitbart was the platform for the alt-right, this place where these online far-right authoritarian activists could have their views heard and talked about. And it's been seen largely as a movement that is non-religious because the issues that they focus on, they do not focus on abortion and same-sex marriage like the religious right does. They focus on banning immigrants and banning Muslims and rolling back civil rights protections. And they focus on the idea that white people in America are experiencing dispossession or even what they call white genocide, and that multiculturalism, or what they often call cultural Marxism, is a threat to white hegemony in the United States. Mm. And so it's been seen very much as an irreligious movement, in part because Richard Spencer, who's the putative spokesperson for the alt-right, has said he's an atheist, he doesn't believe in God, and he frequently makes fun of the religious right, calls them cucks, which is the pejorative term that the alt-right uses for conservatives that they consider to be not sufficiently far-right. But then in the wake of the election, the wake of Trump's election, Spencer told me that there's a new kind of Christian, alt-right Christians, and he intends to work with them in forming a coalition of the alt-right. So for the article, I talked to three people who consider themselves to be alt-right Christians. They all are with different denominations in terms of their denominational affiliation. They don't have that much in common, but they have a lot in common in terms of their white supremacy and their racism, their admiration for Vladimir Putin and far-right political parties in Europe. And we don't know how large this movement is of alt-right Christians, but it's definitely part of the alt-right coalition.
Hmm. And that's not theology. That's politics.
Well.
I mean, the problem that I'm having right this moment is that we have run out of time before we have run out of conversation, and we've got to revisit this because there's so much there, and so much of it unfortunately reminds me of my growing up years in the South and
yes.
the kind of coalitions that went on there that were friends with racism and a whole bunch of other stuff, too.
That's right. That's right.
Sarah Posner is an award-winning investigative journalist whose work on the intersection of religion and politics is published widely. The article is part of the hard-hitting reporting she's been doing around the 2016 election in partnership with the Nation Institute Journalism Fund, and it's a must-read. It's headlined, Amazing Disgrace, and you'll find it in the New Republic magazine. We'll also link to it from stateofbelief.com. Sarah, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the work that you're doing, and I so appreciate you being with us again today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton. I appreciate it.
Before we go, I can remember only three times when, as an adult, I have been scared, really scared, because of something that was predicted to happen in our nation or during the consequences of what had happened in our nation. The first time that I felt such fear was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I watched with high anxiety as President John F. Kennedy talked to the nation about the potential destruction that could result because of the blockade he had set up, prohibiting warships from getting into Cuba. The then Soviet Union had constructed launch pads on the island from which Soviet missiles could be launched right into the United States. When my sociology professor dismissed our class on the day the crisis heightened, he said, I'll see you tomorrow if we're still here. The second time I felt such fear in our nation was late one evening when I was walking from the metro to my condominium in Washington, D.C. It was just after 9/11. Few people were on the streets. Cabs were scarce. And a blend of shock, grief, anxiety, and fear shrouded our nation's capital, crowded with military personnel and covered with barricades protecting monuments and government buildings. The fear came unexpectedly, and all I could do was quicken my steps toward safety. The third time I felt a similar fear was in the early morning hours after Election Day, when it was certain that Donald Trump had been elected President of the United States. Since that moment, the intensity of that fear has come and gone, but never have I been completely without it. I have tried to feel differently. My greatest fear came from his temperament, egotism, lack of knowledge of the Constitution, and of the destruction that he could inflict on our nation and our world. It took a while for me to finally get over those first two fears, though I still remember them well. I have tried hard to shake the fear I feel because of Donald Trump's presence in the Oval Office and the havoc he could wreak in our world. In the solitude of my mind, I have reassessed my patriotism and what good citizenship means right now and demands. At times, I've convinced myself that it's just about me. He can't be that dangerous. I'm overplaying this. But those moments have been few in number. Two events have made this past week revelatory for me. First came the details of the president's proposed budget. Second came the report of our highest level leaders in the security community. The latter report substantiated the fact, not the guess, not the possibility, but the fact that our president is a liar. I have gotten to know our president better this past week. He plays fast and loose with truth. I've gotten to know our president better this past week, and knowing him better has made me feel worse and even more afraid. Our president doesn't know what makes up a great nation. He does not understand that homeland security is as much about quality public education, generosity that moves citizens to take care of people who can't take care of themselves, and generosity that more effectively tears down the barriers between people than launching the weapons of war. He just doesn't know. On this program, State of Belief, for years you have heard me describe the federal budget as a moral document. Look at our economic priorities and you will see our true character. And our priorities and our sense of compassion as well as morality. The true test of a nation is how it treats its poorest people, people in need. This president is willing to weaken our relationships with people around the world, as well as shut down ministries of the heart like Meals on Wheels, and gifts to our souls such as that come from public radio and institutions that nurture our souls with art. The proposed budget the president has presented may not pass as it is. I surely hope it doesn't. But whatever happens to this budget, we now know President Trump's vision. We know what he wants. We know he wants to govern one particular way. We know the hardness of his heart, and we have learned the blindness of vision he has for a great nation. Who knows what he will do with the budget in its final form, with a bulging military, with broken relationships, with greater divides in Congress as well as in the streets? We can't know because we can't trust him. His word is no good. He has robbed us of trust and thus made me more fearful than ever. I love this nation. I've said that to you many times. I love this nation, but I'm scared when I think of its future. What I must say next is, it's all right to be afraid, but we cannot be afraid and not also be hard at work contributing to as much change for the better as we can affect. Now, just one more thing. It's almost here. The 2017 Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards ceremony in Washington, D.C. We'll be celebrating the lifetime of work journalist Diane Rehm has shared with her listeners in Washington, D.C. and around the country. We'll also be honoring attorney, constitutional advocate, and Gold Star dad Kizar Khan. The reception and award ceremony is Tuesday, April 4th at the Mitchell Gold Bob Williams downtown Washington location. In addition to honoring two exemplary Americans, this is also an important fundraiser for Interfaith Alliance. Complete details are available at interfaithalliance.org. Go there, read about it, come if you can. That date again, April 4, 2017, in Washington, D.C. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We're counting on you now more than ever, and quite frankly, so are many listeners who aren't able to find the voices that we amplify week after week anywhere else than on this show. If you've heard something that you found to be helpful, I urge you to share it with others who might also benefit from hearing it. It's easy for you to share that on Facebook and Twitter. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.